This is Spectrum.
Alternative myth, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey guys, today's guest was suggested to me by Klaus Donner. William Brown is a molecular biologist at the Institute for Bioregenesis Research in the University of Hawaii. William's independent research has been focused on investigating the quantum mechanical nature of biological systems, which was largely inspired by the work of Dr. Mei Wan Ho and her amazing book, The Rainbow and the Worm, The Physics of Organisms. This has coincided to some degree with William's academic research as he has been investigating the connective tissue and extracellular matrix, which William quickly realized forms a vast network that connects all 100 trillion cells of the body together in a coherent system capable of non-local communication through macroscopic entanglement of the quantum superpositions. Go ahead, say that bad boy 10 times fast. The most exciting aspect of these new insights is the use of resonant frequencies for modulating biomolecular functions, or what William calls the bioactive frequency modulation. This has the capacity to not only ameliorate all disease, but to prevent the formation of illness in the first place. It could also be used to reverse or even stop the aging process altogether. The possibilities are very exciting. Oh yeah, I'm looking forward to this interview. Let's welcome William Brown. Hello, William. How you doing? Glad to have you on the show.
Doing great, Scott. Thank you. It's an honor to be on the show.
Yeah. I think what we'll do, Tom, is we'll just start out. I want to find out your background. Of course, we've already read your bio, but what got you into researching the sort of things that you're talking about? You gave a speech in South Africa for Michael Tellinger's group. What was the name of that conference again?
It was the UFO Conference on Science and Consciousness.
Right, and you got a standing ovation for your presentation. Now, I'm going to warn people, William is extremely technical in the way he speaks, but that's okay. Tom's going to translate everything. I had to run.
Good luck with that one.
I had to run with that. I'm sorry. So I want to know, how did you get interested in the areas you're talking about? Are you talking about DNA? You're talking about DNA as a transceiver and a receiver, and you gave a speech about monkey DNA, and we'll get into that, about how monkey, there's proof, 100% proof, that monkey DNA has been shown to be genetically manipulated. We're going to get into that story as well. We're going to talk about morphic resonances. We're going to go pretty much all over the map here, but in the beginning, I want to know, how did you originally get interested in all of these sort of alternative ways of looking at things?
Well, as a scientist, I'll have to interject real quick that it's not 100% absolute proof, but I have strong support that there was genetic manipulation of the primate lineage to produce the human species. But just to address your question, I actually got interested in it through just scientific research. I was doing a master's in applied recombinant DNA technology at New York University, and my last class, I was given a final presentation, and the topic of research that I chose was on the divergence of humans from the chimpanzee, the divergence of humans and chimpanzees in evolutionary history, the molecular mechanisms by which humans and chimpanzees diverged. That is to say that within evolutionary theory, they shared a common ancestor, and at some point they split, and one evolved into humans and one evolved into chimpanzees. That's as the theory goes.
Mm-hmm.
But as I began to research the actual genetic basis for this divergence, I found that it was not described by Darwinian theory, by Darwinian evolution, because the chimpanzee and human genome is nearly identical in regards to the protein coding sequences.
Okay.
So this at first was a huge shock to me, because the evolution is supposed to occur via changes in the protein coding sequences of the DNA or genes to produce new novel species. So there should have been genetic mutations that cause new proteins that would be responsible for creating the human species. But there is none of that. The if you actually talk about the numbers, the similarity between the human and chimpanzee protein coding sequences, there's only about a 1% difference. Now, there can be more difference in the protein coding regions between me and you. There can be a larger than 1% difference in that same region between two people than between a given person and a chimpanzee. So this was a major surprise for me, but it also compelled me to find what was the actual molecular basis for the divergence between humans and chimpanzees. And so it was immediately apparent to me that it was that the protein coding sequences only comprise about 2% of the human and chimpanzee genome. So it was immediately evident that if it wasn't those, which it obviously wasn't, it must be the other 98% of the DNA. This is what in popular culture is referred to as junk DNA, simply because it doesn't code for proteins. And from the consensus paradigm, if it doesn't code for proteins, it's non-functional. And this is erroneous on many levels, which is I'm working to show how erroneous this paradigm, this perception is.
Okay.
But at the same time, in parallel with that discovery, I had also opened my mind to investigating other phenomenology, especially UFO phenomenon, alien contacts. And when I actually went to investigate that with an open mind and really weigh the evidence, it was abundantly apparent that there is visitations occurring. There's been a long history of human extraterrestrial interaction and, you know, what is called the ancient alien
theory.
So
as a scientist, you were open enough to look at this stuff and
well, not initially. There was a awakening of sorts that took place. I was actually a very, very empirically based scientist in that I would be pretty much unwilling to even investigate a topic like that for the most part. But at some point I had a awakening, and it was the realization that maybe I didn't have everything all figured out.
Okay.
Maybe there was a lot more to the universe, a lot more going on than what my preconceived notions and assumptions could be. And I really went through a deconstruction phase where I took the perspective that everything I know is wrong. Right. And that actually turned out to be a very, very expansive perspective to step into. And so it was really a 180-degree shift from, you know, pretty extreme skepticism. I've always been intrigued with what would be considered a strange
phenomena.
Strange phenomena. But I went about as far down the rabbit hole as you could go. I mean, I entertain thoughts and ideas and beliefs that pretty much there's very few other people would entertain these kind of ideas.
Within the scientific community of the people that you're working with at the time in New York. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you did this, you were working on a paper? To present, okay. And did you present your findings, and how were they taken?
It went over very well. I actually described a scientific experiment, a number of scientific experiments, different methodologies that could be used to actually identify motifs or sequences within the genome that were specifically involved in the divergence of the human and chimpanzee lineage. And of course, for my presentation in front of, you know, the professors and fellow students, mm-hmm. I didn't bring in any theories about extraterrestrial genetic
manipulation. You didn't say, and therefore aliens made humans. Yeah, okay.
But, you know, it's not that I would be squeamish about that or opposed to doing that. It's that at that point, I didn't have any basis to say that. It was just something that I thought was a very likely explanation, because if it wasn't any kind of natural process, you know, as described by Darwinian evolution, then what exactly was it? I mean, of course, it always could be an unknown natural process. And in a sense, I'm sure that still is, to a large extent, involved. But mm-hmm. I felt very strongly that the hypothesis or perspective, if you will, that a extraterrestrial intelligent civilization may have tweaked the evolutionary path or created genetic circumstance that would favor the emergence of an intelligent species. I thought this was a very likely theory. But so even at that most initial point, I actually identified one of the distinguishing molecular characteristics that I believe to be involved in creating the human species.
Okay. So you've identified something that stood out to you as a marker, or as I think we've talked about this previously, and you called it a hook or something.
Well, a marker. You said it exactly. And actually, interestingly enough, that I took that description from Richard Dawkins.
Okay. Because
in discussing the theory of intelligent design, he comes from a purely rational basis. And this would have been my default mode previously as well. I'm still, you know, firmly investigating with rationality, of course. But he says that, that if there was intelligent design of the human species, then there should be some kind of biochemical marker that would be evidence of that engineering. And this is what I believe I have identified.
You've identified it. Okay, yeah. So if you've identified this as layman terms as possible, I know it's going to be difficult, but because I know you're going to have to use some scientific terminology. Can you explain what that process or marker is?
Well, so within that other 95% of DNA, 50% of that 95% is actually active in that it does code for the intermediary molecule called RNA. Now, what this other 50% can do is through the RNA intermediary, it can mobilize itself and move to other areas in the genome. This is very extraordinary, really, because the idea of the gene was a fixed position within the DNA molecule. In fact, the alternative name within scientific jargon for a gene is locus. We talk about gene loci, and loci is derived from location. So it's a fixed point on that DNA molecule.
Okay.
Well, these novel sequences, they are actually able to move around in the DNA molecule. They're able to transpose themselves to different locations, and this ability gives them the name transposons. And it's actually a large portion of these transposable elements, they do code for molecular machinery or proteins, and the proteins are involved in this translocation.
Okay.
So it's a very, very exciting and interesting aspect of the DNA that it has this mechanism by which it can remodel itself. And there's a lot of interesting phenomena that I'd love to discuss about that. But to stay on topic, this molecular marker, this biochemical marker, belongs to this family of transposable elements. More specifically, it's a retrotransposon, but that is more scientific terminology that isn't as important. And understanding how this element is involved in producing the human species and defining the human being biomolecularly.
Okay.
But within that 95%, 50% are transposable elements. There is a specific retrotransposon called an ALU element. Now, this is a very intriguing element of the genome because it's specific to the primate lineage. It's only found within primates. Okay. But even more interestingly, it's only active within humans. So this is suggestive for a number of reasons, because even the protein coding sequences that are putatively or ostensibly involved in defining what a species is, they're found almost throughout the entire animal kingdom.
Okay.
We share 50% of the protein coding genes we have can be found in fruit flies. You see?
Yeah.
It's so to have a genetic element that is specific for the human species is very suggestive that it has a novel function within the human being to define the organism as a human being. So its biochemical function is going to be involved in making a human being a human being. When you actually look at the structure of the Alu element, it has clear signs to me of actual molecular engineering involved to produce that genetic element.
Now, why would it show, and how could someone like yourself tell that it has signs of genetic, I think we're talking about genetic manipulation here.
Yes.
Well, so when scientists do something, there's something they do with an, and this would only have been found out relatively recent in human history, that to be able to even find out what this marker is or what.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, because we see really, that it's pretty advanced technology. So the reason that I'm able to actually identify this is because of my background in molecular engineering. You know, as I had said, I was getting a master's degree in applied recombinant DNA technology. So that is actually the technology used to engineer the DNA, to manipulate DNA.
Okay.
And so through this technique, you can, my actual objective at that time was to learn that technology to make new species.
All right, okay.
So with this kind of background, when I look at the structural characteristics of this molecule, it has some of the key elements of the technology that we use in engineering molecules to create new biochemicals, biomolecules in organisms. So if you look at the actual molecule that the Alu element codes for, it is a dimer. And a dimer means that there are two molecules that are actually fused together. So this dimer, it has a structure on it, and I have pictures of this that illustrated.
Yeah, and I think you sent them to me, and I will be putting those up on your bio page as well.
Excellent. So if you look at the actual schematic depiction of the molecule, it has a linker sequence on it. It's a polyadenosine linker sequence. So it's just a linear molecule that's a repeat of adenosine molecules that are polymerized together, but it's used to hold these two molecules together. Now, the very interesting thing is that this is exactly the type of engineering that would be done by human scientists to produce a fusion protein to be foreignly expressed in another organism. In fact, I just had a PhD defense recently.
Okay.
So I was giving a presentation to defend my PhD, and they were asking me about a technique I would use to investigate the function of a dimer of a particular molecule. And one of the things that I said I would do is I would create a fusion protein, and I would make a linker sequence between them so that it would assure they would dimerize. So, and this is exactly what is seen in this biomolecule. The thing is, this, to my knowledge, could not arise naturally. There's no genetic mechanism that could explain a linker sequence randomly appearing So in order for this, so within the scientific consensus paradigm, in order for this linker sequence to be present in this biomolecule, it would have to arise through a random mutation process. But that is it's completely untenable.
So knowing what you know, you're going to throw that in the impossible range.
Yeah.
That's impossible. Okay.
Well, and also, taken together with the profound function of this biomolecule within the human species, it really is suggestive of genetic engineering. So that's one of the techniques that is employed to a large extent with genetic engineering. You introduce a molecule that has a linker sequence so that it forms a fusion protein. Another technique that is widely employed, well, almost every single time you have the foreign expression of a gene that you insert into a host organism, one of the things you always do is you include a promoter sequence that is going to drive the expression of that gene, because you're inserting it because you want it to be expressed at a high degree so that it will cause a change in the host organism.
Right.
But if you don't include a hyperactive promoter that is going to increase the expression of that foreign gene, it might not even be expressed at all, because it's a foreign gene. It's a foreign DNA element that you're inserting into a system that is very fine-tuned. It has a pretty low tolerance for this kind of
manipulation.
Yeah, exactly. And so looking at the ALU element promoter region, it has exactly that. It has what's called a retinoic acid receptor, a retinoic acid response element. And this is a promoter that is going to increase the expression of the ALU element in the presence of retinoic acid. The key feature about retinoic acid is it's a molecule that's involved in the development of an organism. So here, this is even more refined than just inserting a hyperactive promoter. Here, you have this very selective promoter that is going to drive the expression of this element in the developing organism. And so if you want to make a primitive hominoid into an intelligent human, you're going to target the development of that organism. That is exactly what is seen here. So
now, would you also see these markers, because you're talking about this as being contained already within the human. People walking around today have this, what you're talking about. Have you seen evidence of these markers with the research you were doing with primates as well?
Well, so that's a very interesting aspect of this, is that so these markers, they are present in other primates, going as far back as even monkeys. But here is actually more proof of the fact that they were engineered and used for the genetic manipulation. They're inactive in all other primate species. They're only active in humans.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a very important reason why this is. So I said that this was a retrotransposable element. It's a mobile genetic element. One of a large class of these elements are actually the result of retroviruses. They were introduced into the primate genome by retroviruses. That's why they're seen in all primates. So these elements are actually shared amongst species. So what happens is, if you put, so if an intelligent
alien species, let's go hey, go big or stay home. If an intelligent alien species.
Yeah, so if an intelligent alien species inserts this engineered molecule, which shows clear evidence of engineering, if they insert that into the, well, before they insert it in, it's just a primitive hominid, if you will. But if they insert that into the genome and make it a human species, of course, I'm sure that there's a lot more to it than just that.
Yeah, this is but just what you things, found with your research. Yeah.
Well, and just to keep it simple, so if you insert that into the genome, you can't just insert it anywhere, because another key feature of the DNA is that most of it is bound up tightly within the nucleus of the cell. It's bound up so that it's inactive. It's not being actively transcribed. This is important for a number of reasons, and it's actually been called epigenetic regulation, which is more scientific terminology. But if you just insert this molecule that you engineered, if you just insert its DNA sequence anywhere in the DNA, it most likely is going to be silenced by this epigenetic regulation. It's going to be in one of the regions that are tightly coiled up. But here's the thing. In the human genome, it's not. In the human genome, this is the most active element of the entire human genome. There's over 1 million copies of the ALU element sequence in the human genome. This is the most active gene humans have. So it's an extremely active gene, but it's completely silent in all other primates. The reason is because it was inserted by an intelligent extraterrestrial species into the genome of this primitive hominoid in a specific location where it would be functionally active. And that sequence, over the course of many thousands of years later, because even hundreds of thousands of years later, it's being shared laterally, horizontally, just like a virus would spread, very similar mechanism, with other primates, but it inserts randomly into the genome, and it's silenced, and it's non-functional.
Okay.
So this is more kind of evidence of intelligent engineering, intelligent modification here.
Intelligent genetic manipulation.
Yeah. And in fact, when you actually investigate the activity of this element, you can see that there was more than one event here. So if it was inserted, say, 250,000 years ago, that is when we have the first fossil evidence of Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, when you look at the archaeological evidence, you don't see any kind of really human-like activity. The stone tools are only marginally more sophisticated than what was being used by Homo erectus, Neanderthal. They're still making stone tools.
Yeah.
But about 50,000 years ago, there's all of a sudden this global ubiquitous change in the human species, and they start doing more human-like activities. You start to see petroglyphs, paintings on cave walls, sophisticated stone tool use. And so what you have, again, you have a close version of this ALU element called it's a very
You're going to hit me with another big scientific word, aren't you?
Well, actually, it's not a big scientific word. It's kind of a very unexciting scientific name. It's just called BC200 Beta.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it sounds naming a planet, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So this BC200 gene is related to the ILU element, possibly derived from it. And this is only active in the human brain. So it has a specific localization to the human brain, and it's one of the few retrotransposable elements that are active at all. And it's most active in the human brain. And what is one of the defining characteristics of the human species? It's this large cortex. Mm-hmm. All this cortical tissue, this huge brain. So if you look at it, it shows, and actually it's another figure that I sent that you might be able to show.
I will.
It says, interestingly, the BC200 beta pseudogene may have been generated by a conversion-like event after the human-chimpanzee divergence. But what that's saying is that, I said 250,000 years ago, you see fossil evidence of Homo sapiens, but no evidence for intelligent activity. But then 50,000 years ago, you start to see evidence of intelligent activity. And here, there's, again, molecular evidence that there was a change in this genetic element after that divergence, after that genetic manipulation.
Okay, so it was like phase two of humans.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so how does this arise naturally? Well, it doesn't. And one of the key reasons is because this is 200,000 years after the human species had emerged.
Right.
Humans are nearly globally distributed. If this arose in a very small population, which is how it would have to arise by natural Darwinian mechanisms, if it arose in a small population, how would it be globally distributed the next day?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they do have horizontal transfer, much like a retrovirus would, but it's my supposition that this was maybe even a second extraterrestrial species that engineered the same molecule,
mm-hmm.
and, well, engineered the same molecule to a different isoform that is brain-specific and is going to drive higher intelligent functioning. And that's how it's found worldwide, is that it wasn't inserted into one group of humans. It was inserted into all humans.
Globally.
And, and what kind of, being has the technology and the capability 50,000 years ago to travel around the globe engineering somewhat primitive human beings,
That's a really good question. I want to ask our resident director of MUFON Ontario, Tom, who did that?
Thank you, Brian, though.
No, it's very intriguing.
Should I guess?
Okay, go ahead. Do you have a question?
Tall white guys?
Yeah, maybe. Okay. So what do you think, Tom? Do you think that it's pretty interesting that because we've heard about this, being in the field that we have, we've heard about this theory, the ancient astronaut theory, the intervention theory, where, other species, other alien species have come on and sort of manipulated humans to early hominids to become humans. What's your opinion, Tom?
Well, I was having a similar conversation yesterday with another friend of mine, and we were talking about, the what happened to the Neanderthals and if we were at the same time as Neanderthals, you know, do we have part of them, or are we part of that particular species? So I'm still kind of intrigued, and maybe I wanted to get the opinion of William as to what he thought.
Well, so there's actually, it's been empirically verified that we actually do carry Neanderthal DNA. In fact, the character trait of red hair is from Neanderthal DNA. So there was definite hybridization of the species to produce.
Were we a continuation, let's say, based on the regular scientific theory? Was this a continuation, you know, Neanderthal being the pre, you know, modern human?
No. So actually, they existed in parallel. And right. The human species actually, throughout the history of the Neanderthal. The Neanderthal goes back to about 300,000 years ago and was the result of, was derived from a Homo erectus-like ancestor. But I would be so bold as to suggest that was the result of extraterrestrial genetic modification as well to produce the Neanderthal. For largely, you know, under what motivation, I think largely experimental reasons. Mm. But, you know, that's just slightly older than the humans, Homo sapiens, which are 200 to 250,000 years old. So they really existed in parallel to a large degree. But it's right around the time that you see this increase in intelligent activity of the Homo sapiens that you see a decrease in Neanderthal populations, which is highly suggestive as well. So it appears that they were Homo sapiens and Neanderthal were living relatively harmoniously. I mean, they were interbreeding, you know, producing hybrid children up until a very specific point at which the Neanderthals disappeared while the human population
expanded.
Yeah. So, you know,
and that could be the
any idea what?
Well, I think that before this phase two human, as Scott so appropriately termed it, I think before that, human beings may not have been as aggressive, perhaps. There wasn't the proclivity for
violence.
Yeah, violence. So maybe not organized type violence. You know, maybe it's wrong of me to suggest that, you know, it was the human fault for the disappearance of the Neanderthal. You know, I don't have any kind of, you know, empirical evidence to suggest that.
Yeah, it could be just that they were competing for the same resources, the same food, the same space, and the more intelligent humans were just better at getting everything.
That's a great point.
No, but Scott, a lot of the sites that they had in Southern Europe, there was no human, you know, intervention, let's call it, that was found. I mean, it was, you know, their site is pretty much just Neanderthal.
Well, I mean,
so if there was any fighting.
Right, let's go even further. If the Neanderthal was genetically manipulated versions, they could also have a built-in kill switch.
Yeah. Well, and if they were an experiment, the next phase of the experiment might have been by the extraterrestrials to remove the Neanderthals so that they can focus on this new human without...
Yeah, that would make more sense.
Yeah,
that makes more sense, too. Yeah, because you're right, Tom. There have been areas, now that I think about it, there have been areas where there's vast bones been found of Neanderthal and no human, current human bones found anywhere near them.
Exactly.
Right. So, I mean, what wiped them out, right? They could have had a kill switch. They could have had a kill switch built into them, a biological kill switch that, when just turned off, that's it. That's no more children. End of species.
And even within the human species, part of the experimentation has been to a large degree to keep a lot of the subpopulations isolated, all over. So, you have these small study groups. You keep them isolated from each other.
Oh, right.
Let's say in the normal scientific world, the explanation of Neanderthal disappearance, they have, numerous ideas that, that could have caused that. But in reality, most of these theories are pretty lame, because if you have a species that, is kind of similar. Neanderthal, had a, a brain similar to ours, did it not?
It was actually a larger. They had a larger brain, in fact.
So potentially, we were on the same sort of level mentally, let's call it, as them. So for us to be able to outwit them and wipe them out, from all over the world, that would have been pretty unusual.
And like I said before, it doesn't make sense if there's vast areas of Neanderthal bones but no, other human bones that would lead to that conclusion of wiping them out or out-competing them for the resources as well, because they're just... The human bones aren't found in that area.
Right. So it's only logical to think that Neanderthal might have been just the precursor to us, and then once we came along, they got rid of them.
That's highly possible. I mean, if these guys are working on the level of genetic manipulation that William and people like him are just recently working on that level now, and let's just say take what William knows about genetic manipulation and times that by another 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, could you just imagine what they could do?
Well, because the sequences, the elements that they're working with, our scientists call it junk.
Yeah.
You see how far away we are from, the level of understanding that is being employed here.
Well, that's actually a really good lead-in. You've spoken to me about DNA being a receiver and a transmitter. I also want to ask you another question. Do you think that there was more strands of DNA in the past and that we've been sort of trimmed down to two? I mean, this is something that's been out there in the alternative field for a while. They talk about 12 strands of DNA or three strands of DNA, snipped down to two. What's your opinion on that? And then we'll talk about DNA as a receiver transmitter.
Well, I think that the perspective of, say, 12-stranded DNA, what you're actually talking about is energetic levels of the DNA molecule. So within the physical 4D reality that we inhabit, there are two physical strands of DNA. Actually, I'll have to correct myself, because that is the predominant form, but there are actually three-stranded isoforms, four-stranded forms, and possibly even greater. And they exist within our DNA, and they are functional right now. So, I mean, within all of us, there are four-stranded DNA. It comprises small regions of the genome, and a lot of it is transiently present. But even right now, there are regions of the DNA molecule that are that they call it the G quadruplex,
okay.
For a nice large scientific term. But what that is it's a four-stranded DNA structure of the telomere, the human chromosome. But I'm of the perspective that there are two physical strands of DNA, largely, but there are energetic strands of the DNA as well, up to, I believe, 12 strands, because if you look at the crystalline structure of the DNA, it actually is an aperiodic crystal, and it seems to have what's called dodecahedral symmetry. And one of the things of a aperiodic crystal with dodecahedral symmetry is that it has 12-sided symmetry. So a 12-stranded DNA matrix is actually, I think, energetically sensible. I do believe that to a large extent. But so what are those, say, 10 energetic strands involved in?
There we go.
I think they're actually what is the information processing function of the DNA. Now, I think that what has happened through genetic manipulation, to a large extent, is that the access to that quantum level of information has been disconnected. And there's a very specific way that was done, that it has been done.
Okay.
And that is, again, these transposable elements. I had said they're able to remodel the genome. And it already appears that these transposable elements are what are being utilized for engineering, genetic manipulation, etc. Well, how do you disconnect the DNA molecule from its 100% efficiency of accessing that information? You remodel the chromosomes. You remodel the genome through these transposable elements. So it could be a number of different reasons, environmental catastrophes, human action over thousands of years, and extraterrestrial manipulation that has remodeled the genome such that it is only at a fraction of the efficiency that it used to have in interacting with these higher level strands, these energetic strands.
Now, would this go into the morphic field concept?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Because it's actually the architecture of the genome, the sequence of the motifs of these transposable elements, how they are arranged is very important, and not only how they are being expressed, but in how the kind of conformations that they can adopt. So I had already said that in all of us, the DNA is adopting these unique conformations, such as tertiary three-stranded DNA, quaternary four-stranded DNA. Well, it has a whole host of these conformations that, you know, that 95% of so-called junk DNA can adopt. And it's very dependent on how the overall chromosome is modeled, the architecture of it. And so the point is with this high degree of plasticity, this ability of the DNA polymer to adopt these very unique and specific conformations, it's able to form resonant structures with the morphic field. So when it can form, when it can adopt these unique conformations, it can actually resonate specifically with certain aspects of the morphogenetic field to have that morphic resonance and pull information from the morphic field into the DNA molecule and into the organism. This is one of the many ways by which it's done, is the plasticity of the DNA molecule.
Okay.
It's actually, there's a number of ways. It's really fascinating, very, unfortunately, somewhat complex, because not only can the DNA molecule itself form very unique conformations, but it can be transcribed to form the RNA intermediary. And the RNA intermediary can form very complex structures. And it is the conformation of these structures that allow it to resonate with in a very specific way to access a very specific program of information from the morphogenetic field, from the morphic field.
And do you think that this allows the possibility for human, I want to say the word evolution now, but you know what I mean, for the change in the human biology and changing everything?
Absolutely. Because when these transposable elements were first discovered by Barbara McClintock in the 50s, early 50s, she hypothesized that their function was to be activated by the organism to remodel the chromosomes to produce novel sequences and motifs within the genome that would increase the survivability of the organism. So say if there was some kind of environmental stress, some kind of environmental catastrophe, the organism would be under a high degree of stress. This would trigger these transposable elements. They would activate and mobilize, remodel the DNA, producing novel sequences, a novel architecture, and would basically produce punctuated speciation, a complete change in the organism, but that could very well increase the survivability, the adaptability of that organism. Now, this, I believe, is exactly what is occurring in human beings. The transposable elements are being activated, they're being mobilized by environmental sources, by human behavior, perhaps still by extraterrestrial involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really a choice on which way, how they're going to remodel. Are they going to remodel so that it's restoring the DNA to that 100% efficiency, or, I mean, maybe optimistically 80% efficiency, mm-hmm, of accessing this quantum level information, this morphic resonance with the information field? Is it going to remodel in such a way that we increase our ability to access this kind of information?
Or is they going to flip the kill switch?
And I think that it can go either way. I think it largely depends on
human consciousness.
Yeah.
It's, we're talking about a morphic field, and all humans are plugged into that morphic field. And this possibly is where we can lead into our next area, whereas where you talk about DNA as a receptor and a transmitter.
When you talk about the information that is being accessed by DNA, what kind of information? What information? And it's actually the very thoughts that we're thinking, the very experiences that we're having. Those experiences are being transmitted through the DNA to an information field, and the subsequent thoughts are being received by the DNA and transmitted into our physical mind, our waking consciousness. What I posit is that the actual physical consciousness goes all the way down to the level of the DNA. The DNA molecule itself is responsible for our physical mind behavior, our consciousness, our waking consciousness. So in the present paradigm, the present scientific paradigm, the human consciousness is a result of the biochemical activity of the synapse, of the synapses, 100 trillion of them, of the brain, and the resulting action potential and propagation of an electric wave. But it's my supposition that it actually goes all the way down to the level of the DNA. Now, there's some very important research that has been done within the scientific community showing the nanomolecular structures involved in actual consciousness, in the activity of the physical mind, by Tom Hameroff, Roger Penrose, a number of other researchers who have identified actually subcellular structures, structures, biomolecules that exist within the cell that are involved in the actual activity of the brain to produce our waking consciousness. Now, the way that these biomolecules are hypothesized to function is through actual macroscopic quantum states. So states such as superposition, quantum entanglement, all of these are posited to be involved in the function of the physical mind by these subcellular structures. So what I'm saying is that the activity of the physical mind that is obviously correlated with our behavioral patterns, our thought patterns, this is not purely at the level of the synapse. It actually goes deeper than that. It goes to the subsynaptic structures, which link to the subcellular intercellular structures called actually microtubules, actin. It's referred to scientifically as the cytoskeleton. But through actually macroscopic quantum coherent states, it can actually be involved in the information processing, involved in producing behavioral responses to environmental conditions, you know, what we're perceiving in our physical reality, etc. But what I have shown is that these microtubules, these subcellular structures, they're connected directly to the nucleus of every single neuron. and right there on the nuclear membrane through the nuclear matrix, another system of nanostructures, proteins that are involved in this quantum transduction of energy, right there connected to them is the DNA molecule. And so, and it's been shown that states of consciousness, thoughts, actually do change the expression of the DNA itself. Different RNA isoforms are transcribed from the DNA with different kind of cortical activity, activity of the brain. Now, there's further evidence for how the basis of behavior, thoughts, etc., is actually located within the DNA. My favorite example is mind-controlling viruses and fungi.
Okay, this sounds interesting.
So, there's a number of different viruses and fungi. Now, these are supposed to be the most primitive type of organism there is. In fact, there's a large debate on if they're even living or not. You know, they might just be biomolecular automaton. You know, it's not even fully accepted scientifically that they're living. That's how primitive they're supposed to be. But there's a large class of these viruses and fungi that can infect a host organism and completely hijack and take over its mind. They can hijack its behavioral patterns. It oftentimes producing complex behaviors that go well beyond
automaton. Just,
well beyond just merely automaton.
You were telling me a story about an ant. That there is a, tell me that story again.
Well, so there's an ant that is infected by a particular type of fungus. And the fungus is an intracellular parasite and infects the nervous system of the ant. And the ant comes into contact with this by eating the dung of cows, grazing cows.
Okay.
But what happens is it'll eat this, the parasite, the fungi will invade its brain, its nervous system. Now, the ant will go along during the day as if nothing is abnormal, doing its normal ant-like activities. But then, as soon as night falls, all the normal ants, they go back into the den, their ant hole, their home. These infected ants, they crawl up a very particular, a very specific plant. They crawl up to the uppermost region of it where there are these flowers, and they perch right there, and they sit and they wait all night. They don't move. Now, the reason is so that they will be eaten by the grazing cows. This just so happens to complete the life cycle of the invading host organism, the invading fungus. Now, if the ant isn't eaten, as soon as daylight breaks, it comes to from this zombie-like state, crawls down from the plant, and goes about normal ant behavior, and the subsequent night goes back and does the same exact thing.
Wow. So it's rather, that's mind control.
Yeah, mind control. Exactly. There's even a spider that it can be infected, and it has a completely new web building. It will make a completely different kind of web architecture that just so happens to be exactly what the host organism needs to complete the life cycle. So, you know, that's kind of interesting. But this isn't exclusive to insects and what is considered supposedly simple organisms. Even higher mammals.
Well, rabies. Rabies.
Exactly. So when even a human is infected, there's definite behavioral changes. And one of the specific behavioral changes, it just so happens that the host organism has the uncontrollable urge to bite anything in its vicinity, any living organism in its vicinity. So I took this specific example of a mind-controlling virus because in accordance with the consensus paradigm, that virus should encode some kind of protein that functions as a neurotransmitter or a neurotransmitter analog to produce this aberration in activity and behavior. Because if all of our behaviors and activities are the result of the biochemical activity at the synapse, then it should be hijacking our behavioral patterns through some form of secretion of its own neurotransmitter, one encoded within the rabies virus. And so the rabies virus, the genome is completely sequenced. It's annotated so that all the genes are known. And there is not a single neurotransmitter encoded within the rabies virus. In fact, all that it codes for, as far as protein synthesis is concerned, is the viral coat by which it packages itself to infect the neighboring cell or, you know, neighboring organism through the saliva. So the viral protein coat and the molecular machinery to replicate the DNA. That's it. That's all the DNA codes for.
Okay.
So how is it possible that all that you have, once it infects, you just have this naked DNA molecule, and all it's doing is making virus protein coats and polymerases to replicate the DNA. How are they mind controlling their host? How are they producing, in some instances, complex behavioral programs? And the answer is because of the quantum activity of the DNA molecule. Because, you know, the DNA molecule, sure, it has a codon, a code sequence that is making proteins, but it's also adopting specific structural conformations that bring it into morphic resonance with the morphogenetic field so that the information is passing through the DNA molecule into the microtubule intercellular matrix, through that into the synapse, and creating an aberration or abnormal functioning of the synaptic activity in a very unique and specific way to hijack the behavioral program of the host organism. It's the DNA. So what you have is the reception of a behavioral program by the DNA molecule from the information field to direct the activity of the host organism. So this is a clear-cut example of the DNA's involvement in direct cognitive function. So that's kind of in line with how, you know, I view the DNA molecule to be functioning constitutively. Even within the human being, the DNA molecule is transmitting and receiving this kind of information that is largely responsible for our conscious awareness. So if we increase, what does it mean to increase the efficiency of the DNA molecule in accessing this information? It means that you increase your awareness. You increase the number of things that you're aware of in your environment that are being transmitted to the non-physical portions of your mind that exist in the information field. And you're increasing the awareness of the thought patterns, the cognition that is being transmitted back through the DNA into your physical mind. Because you know that, I mean, even within our waking consciousness, there's a large degree of the information that we're receiving that we're are not conscious of, we're not aware of it. There's a large degree of our behaviors that are completely unconscious. So, you know, increasing the conscious awareness, become more aware of what is going on around you, and more aware of different thoughts and ideas occurring in, you know, your own head.
Okay.
So, William, you have a page on your website called The Light Body. Can you explain that for us?
Well, just as I had discussed before, the information processing activity of these biomolecules, these intercellular filaments such as microtubules and DNA, the information processing activity is to a large extent involving the activity of light, of living light, if you will.
Okay.
What has been referred to as biophotons, even biophoton emission. And this has been posited to be involved in a sort of communication system of the biological system of any organism. And so, say that the DNA molecule has received through morphic resonance, through the quantum field, information, specific program of information. How is that then transmitted to, say, the physical awareness, the physical consciousness, or even at an unconscious level, how is it transmitted to the cellular environment if it's to affect the function of a tissue, say, in development?
So if we're talking here, you know, real-world stuff, if we're talking here about, say, you want to heal a part of your body or you want to, you want to change something within your system, this is maybe – you're talking like a mechanism aspect to this.
Yes, very much so, because if the body is communicating through this light transmission, then you can affect what kind of information is being transmitted, is being communicated through the application of light-based therapy. So, say that you have a biomolecule that is receiving a discordant message through this light transmission.
Okay. And that translates to lung cancer.
Exactly, yes. So, say that the biomolecule is receiving a discordant message. The electromagnetic frequency is not the normal frequency for a normal behavior of the biomolecule for a number of reasons. Well, if you can determine what the proper harmonious electromagnetic frequency is, you can supplant that. You can, outside of the body, introduce a electromagnetic frequency, a light, that is going to adjust the behavior of that biomolecule, and you can restore the functionality of the body and so get rid of the lung cancer, not by attacking the body, but by readjusting the communication, the information transmission, such that it's restored to the proper harmonious information transmission so that that biomolecule comes back into the system. It comes back into functioning coherently within the system.
So like a string on a guitar.
Exactly.
That's out of tune. You're just tightening it up and retuning it to the proper chord.
Now, in terms of biophotons, in terms of the electromagnetic frequency, there are 72 octaves within the electromagnetic spectrum. So if you're talking about the number of different notes that can be played, it can be fine-tuned to an amazing degree. And so what that translates to is that this biomolecule is going to have an electromagnetic signature that is distinct and unique from every other constituent of the body. So its communication with the DNA is deriving its behavioral pattern, just like the organism does as a whole. It's that frequency of communication is a very specific and unique frequency. It's got a specific electromagnetic signature because there are 72 octaves within the electromagnetic frequency spectrum from which to choose from. Okay. So if you can identify that, you can reintroduce that specific electromagnetic frequency, and you only affect that aberrantly behaving biomolecule. There are no side effects.
And this sounds to me where crystals would come in.
Oh, yes. So if you think about the function of a crystal, even how it's used scientifically, within, say, quantum mechanics experiments, the crystal is used for, in many instances, experiments with light. The crystal can be used to store light, transduce it, and transmit it. And this oftentimes involves quantum states of the crystal, because that extreme ordered periodicity of the atomic structure, that lattice-like structure of the crystal, is very amenable to the transference of quantum states. But when you look at the biological being, at first sight, it looks anything but a crystalline in nature. Mm-hmm. It's described as wet, moist, and chaotic. That is highly erroneous. In fact, most of the body's biomolecular structures are paracrystalline in nature. They're not complete crystals, but they have very crystalline-like features. And in fact, when they're isolated and purified, they can be crystallized. This is how we know a great degree of what they look like. What is their actual atomic structure? That's done by crystallizing the biological molecules, crystallizing them and doing X-ray diffraction studies, shining an X-ray through them and looking at the diffraction pattern to determine where electrons are, where protons are, etc. So I'd already said the DNA molecule is aperiodic crystal. The microtubule has this hexagonal crystalline structure. And what this does is it is specifically involved and the ability of these molecules to receive, transduce, and transmit light, electromagnetic frequencies. So not only for light storage, but the processing of the light you could even think of it as a kind of a computation.
Mm-hmm.
And then subsequent transmission. And I should also say that it's not just light, it's also sound.
I was actually going to say that, yeah.
So it's actually sound as well. One of the very interesting aspect of these paracrystalline filaments is that they can have mechanical kinks in them, in the structure, these kinks. And this is on a very femtosecond, picosecond scale, you know, ultra fast, these little structural kinks. And what it actually can do is form a soliton-like wave. That's kind of a technical term, but it's one used in quantum physics. But what it can be like a propagating wave along the microtubule itself. And with an association with the liquid crystalline water that is always associated with any biological system, any of the biological units, the soliton-like wave can form a quantum coherent state so that it actually forms a kind of entangled state, what has been likened to a Bose-Einstein condensate, where there's non-local transmission of possibly information. And now, the soliton propagation can produce phonons even. Phonons can produce low-frequency sound waves. So there's this transmission of not only light through, say, the microtubule, through interaction with the quantized electromagnetic field, but also transmission of sound through the soliton-like propagation and phonon emission. And so it's really like a light and sound orchestra inside the cell, transmitting and receiving information, which is propagated outside of the cell.
Non-locally,
so that the body functions as a whole unit. You know, there's practically the big toe in your foot is functioning coherently with the neuron in your cortex. It's one quantum coherent system.
Right.
And that's being done to a large extent by that non-local, quasi-instantaneous transmission of information through light and sound.
So, I mean, I wonder if this could explain altered states of consciousness if we're talking about the human body as being a receiver and transmitter at the cellular level, whether or not what we could be talking about is tapping into non-local states of consciousness, non-local aspects of awareness, and first of all, and secondly, can you build a machine to access
that? Those are great points. So, if there is this propensity for the biomolecules to form these macroscopic quantum coherent states where the entire body is functioning as one quantum coherent whole, why don't we really experience that to a large extent in our day-to-day activities?
There you go.
Now, the reason is that the quantum coherent state is fragile. so much so that there's a lot of argument that it couldn't even exist within the biological system. Although there's a lot of evidence that is emerging on how it can indeed exist within the biological system. But even with that being said, it is a fragile state. It exists at picosecond timescales. This is like 10 to the negative 12th of a second, a billionth of a second, a trillionth of a second. Very, very fleeting. But one of the ways that quantum coherent states are produced, even within the laboratory, is by sheltering the system significantly, sufficiently, from interaction with the environment. The more you can shelter the system from interaction with the environment, the larger the quantum coherent state is retained. This applies equally well to the macroscopic quantum coherence of the biological system. The more that you are actually sheltered from environmental influences, environmental interactions, the longer this quantum coherent state exists. So on a picosecond scale, it's flashing on and off, allowing us to access information from the non-local field, from the morphogenetic field.
Higher states of awareness.
Higher states of awareness. Well, even in our waking consciousness, we're doing it all the time, and it's just flashing on and off exceedingly fleetingly, but that is still the mechanism by which we're perceiving reality and acting on our perceptions of reality, etc. But if you go into a state in which you're actually sheltering yourself from environmental influences, which is what better term to describe meditation?
meditative. I was going to say, you just explained the yogi in the cave living in the mountain. Yeah,
exactly. So, sheltering yourself from external sounds, light, etc., a meditative state. What you begin to do is prolong the longevity of these macroscopic quantum coherent states. They are always constitutively active, but when they become active for longer and longer periods, it becomes noticeable. You all of a sudden begin to feel as if your entire body is one. You go even deeper. You shelter yourself even further from these environmental interactions, and you begin to feel that you are one with the entire universe.
Okay.
This is a melding of your macroscopic quantum coherent superposition of your biological system with that non-local field that permeates all of the universe instantaneously, simultaneously. You become aware of this connection. It's always there, but you become aware of it. And this is the sensation that you have. And, as far as the ability to coherently order the DNA, states like this are going to greatly increase the efficacy of how well that DNA can be coherently remodeled to increase these kind of states, to increase the longevity of the macroscopic quantum coherent state, to access the information field for expanded states of awareness.
And extended.
Yes.
Extended as well, extended states of awareness. And I'm wondering if this would sort of explain, to some degree, when people have near-death experiences, they die from the biological and, they're gone for a while and they're brought back and then they come back, but they've extended the time in that other non-local than other non-local universe or non-local position, that when they do come back in the body, they've had this extended experience that's not normally available when you're living in the biological unit. So when they do come back, they have all these extra sort of deep thoughts and psychic abilities and all of these things that are reported by people who have died and been brought back to life, that they've spent an extended time in the non-local.
Very much so. Now, you had also mentioned possible technological applications.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could build something that could help us with this.
Well, so, the biological system is one of the few systems that are known that can, well, it's not proven yet. This is still highly controversial, of course, but it could be that it's one of the few systems that can achieve this macroscopic quantum coherence at ambient room temperature, or even at the temperature of the body.
Yeah.
So, you know, these macroscopic quantum coherent states are achievable in the laboratory, and they produce a phenomenon like superfluidity, and even, you know, that's the basis of quantum computing. And so, you know, a technology like quantum computers is very desirable, but you know, the technological feasibility is it's very technically complex.
Well, they have to be cool, don't they?
Yeah, it has to be extremely cold, and I mean, they have a great degree of difficulty in isolating even a 4, 10, or 16 qubit system from environmental interaction. You know, indeed, it has to be extremely low temperatures, 300 Kelvin below the human body temperature. But if the biological system is unique among other states of matter and its ability to form quantum coherent states, even at high temperatures, that can be utilized. That the ability of the biological system to do that can be reverse engineered to have room temperature quantum computers that have a lot more qubits than just 16.
Right.
The biological system has a qubit system with 3 billion.
I
don't think at this point.
Well, that would be almost godlike, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. And that's what I'm actually asserting, is that we ultimately do have that ability. Not right now, because those qubits, those 3 billion qubits, aren't ordered coherently. But if they were ordered in such a manner, I do believe that, because if you have open constitutive interaction with the unified field, you do have godlike ability. I mean, you know, what is occurring at the farthest reaches of the universe.
Instantaneously.
Instantaneously, yeah. So, I mean, that is, you know, whether or not that will be achievable.
So that would be humans phase 3.
Human phase 3.
And maybe the year 2012, maybe that's what this is all about, is humans phase 3.
Yeah.
A gradual progression into another dynamic of the human biological unit.
I believe that's absolutely correct, yeah.
And you're going to be alive for it, hopefully.
I hope so.
And you're working in the field. I mean, you've told me some of the things that you're considering, you know, wanting to work on. One of the things I think you mentioned was to use the DNA, to use a DNA molecule, a DNA strand, as a receiver for cosmic radiation. and things like these are just like things you've had rolling around in your head as possible experiments in the future.
Well, so it's actually already been shown that the DNA molecule is activated by cosmic radiation, specifically gamma radiation. Now, cosmic radiation is a little bit higher energetically, but it's the same type of wavelength, the same type of frequency. When the DNA is exposed to this gamma radiation, the transposable elements are mobilized. It begins remodeling itself.
It becomes very active.
Very active. Now, the thing is so gamma rays are extremely high energy, so they're very, very small wavelength of light. We can obviously detect them because we know about them, but say that they were undetectable. Say that they were at such a high energy, they were such a subtle form of radiation that we couldn't divide, that we didn't have a technology that was able to even register their existence.
I think I know where you're going. What about the theoretical concept of dark energy?
Well,
you know, the zero-point field.
The zero-point field. So that is, you know, that extremely fine, that extremely subtle level of energy that I'm actually discussing here. So the DNA molecule, when it's accessing the information field, that is the energetic level of the zero-point field. It's actually dipping into that level to derive information, to access information. So the interaction, its interface with the zero-point field is causing differential activity of the DNA molecule so that it can transduce that information to the biological system, the organism.
That's interesting.
So if the DNA is forming an interface with the zero-point field, then you should be able to have a detector of the large DNA molecule. You can easily detect its activity. If you have a detector of the activity of the DNA molecule, you can have it such that it registers when specifically the DNA molecule is forming that interface with the zero-point field. So that when there is a transmission of that subtle energy that is undetectable at this point between the DNA and that unified field, if you had a detector that would register the changes in the DNA that occur upon that activity, what you would have is a device that can detect activity within the zero-point field.
Exactly.
It would be a direct detector of that, you know, at this point, seemingly undetectable level of reality. You know, that's the fundamental fabric of reality. And I think that is the, you know, it's the basement of reality. And I think that is where the consciousness really resides. So the DNA, in order to transmit that information of our physical experience and receive cognition on how we're going to behave, it has to interface with that fundamental fabric of reality to do so. And so by you know, forming detection device with the DNA, you can actually detect what would be known as dark energy.
And yeah, you know, this is interesting. We're actually coming to the end of the show, but I'm wondering if this, what you're talking about, could possibly explain the concept of UFOs that have been found to be of a biological, material, biological nature, and also explain how they can morph from one ball of light to two ball of lights, and also change size from a small craft to a very large craft, and the biological unit or the beings that are within the craft are sort of interacting with the craft on a higher level, on a non-local level, and they can instantaneously change that craft because they're hooked up to it in a non-local way.
And so if the biological system is ostensibly, possibly, the highest technological form of matter achievable, then these extraterrestrial species, their technology may be based on utilizing the inherent capabilities of their own biological system. So to varying degrees. So you can have a interface of, external technology with the biological system. So you get something like, say, the Montauk chair, where, you know, you have this actual physical external craft, but the functional, the engine, the driving unit of that craft is the biological being inside. It's just, you can go to a deeper level of technology where it's just the biological unit itself. I mean, one of the phenomenon of quantum activity is teleportation.
Right.
Say that you have a biological extraterrestrial entity, an alien, that has learned to utilize the technology, the inherent technology of the biological system, which is the apex of technological capability of physical matter, then it may be able to teleport nearly instantaneously to anywhere via its own biological system. You know, and that may appear as a ball of light, you know, to us.
Exactly, because it would transform into a, the information of photons and light that you were talking about, into a ball form of light, transport somewhere else, and then take on physical shape again.
And what you could be seeing is even the quantum field that exists around every biological entity, the quantum field that is produced from the coherent activity of 100 trillion DNA molecules, more or less, for any given organism.
Also known as the aura.
The aura. Well, or even, it's also been referred to as the Merkaba.
Yeah, that's true.
And, there's historical descriptions of even a human being, Elijah, who activated his Merkaba. Perhaps it was he was of the level of awareness and coherence that he could activate the quantum field of his being and translocate to maybe, that non-local field of existence. Who knows?
Yeah, and in other words, basically you're switching to switching biologically to another dimension, and then retuning and reappearing somewhere else. And this also would be quantum entanglement. You could do the same sort of thing from one end of the universe to the other end, if there is an end. which I'm not sure there is.
I don't think so.
I think it's boundless luminosity of infinite space. So that's a nod to Adam Tremblay, because that's his quote. I really appreciate you coming on the show. I think that there's another 4 to 6 hours that we could cover. Looking at my notes here, morphic resonance and macroquantum nanobiology, I'm going down the list here, and I'm realizing that there's a bunch of things that we didn't even cover yet. So, but we're over our time, and we're probably going to have to do that on a follow-up show. And Tom will, of course, again, translate everything you're saying.
Oh, definitely.
And we'll do that. I really appreciate William coming on the show.
Hey.
Well, I really look forward to hopefully a follow-up discussion.
If you could just give everybody your website address and they could go there and check out all of the fantastic information you have. Also, you're probably going to be doing another another talk this summer. Do you know whether you are or not?
Quite possibly. With Nexus Magazine, there's a possibility.
Okay.
Duncan, the editor of Nexus Magazine, he seemed quite enthusiastic on getting me to Australia to do a talk. So there's a possibility. We haven't discussed it in any further detail than
okay.
that.
Could you just give everybody your website address?
So it's kind of a lengthy one, but it's WilliamBrownScienceOfLife.com. William Brown Science of Life is all one word.
And there'll be a link on your bio page. There'll be a link in the upcoming show section. The day after the show, there'll be a link in your archive section. So don't worry about that. We'll have all the links and the pictures you send me trying to sort of visually explain the technical things that you were saying.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Well, thanks, William, for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
And, thank you so much for having me.
And we'll catch you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Next time.